Let me just start by giving you an outline of what I'm going to be doing for the four sessions. Today is Tuesday, and can you see it? I'll hold it up. Today we're going to be talking about what we do with our enemies, and I'll explain that in a minute as we begin. But I want to let you know the flow of what I'm going to be presenting. Tomorrow is going to be more or less some biblical reflections on where does the basis for peacemaking come. The Bible certainly says that peace is a good thing, but is it helpful for us in envisioning what peace might look like and how we get there? So we're going to talk about two different biblical themes in the Old Testament and the New Testament that shapes our call to be peacemakers. Thursday, we're really going to do the flip side of that and talk about when we don't heed that call, what happens? What are the costs of the opposite of peacemaking? What are the costs of war making? And then Friday is going to be mostly conversation about peacemakers who inspire us and give us hope for the future. Because I think that what gives us energy to go on as peacemakers in the world is other people, men and women, who are examples and models for us. Let me just say that throughout these four sessions, I'm going to be weaving in personal peacemaking and corporate peacemaking between nations. And I hope you're comfortable with that. And the reason I do that is because I think they have a lot to do with each other. That one of the reasons we study national and international issues sometimes is to learn how to get along with the person sitting next to us. And we can learn a lot from getting along with the person next to us about national and international peacemaking. So those will be interwoven, and I hope that we can be doing some connecting with, if for you the primary issue is personal peacemaking with a neighbor, that you can learn from the other and vice versa. But just so you know, probably this session, the first session and the third session would have more to do with the social, the national and international peacemaking, and we as Americans and we as a world community, these two sessions will probably connect more with individual peacemaking. But as I said, those will be woven in and out. Okay? Any questions about that so far? I'll just leave this up here, so if you need to refer back to it or wonder what is he talking about, you can at least have this sheet. Okay. For today, I wanted to start with enemies, and it seems like a strange place to start, talking about enemies, but I don't think so, because when we talk about being a peacemaker, the most difficult part of being a peacemaker is when we're confronted by enemies. It's not very difficult to be a peacemaker if everybody you meet becomes your friend, or everyone you meet you get along with. It's when the difficulty becomes when you clash with someone else, someone who begins to despise you, someone who threatens you or the values that you live for, when someone attacks you either physically or verbally, that's when it becomes difficult to be a peacemaker. And that's true both for individuals and for nations. So enemies, I think, are the whole reason that we talk about peacemaking in the first place. So it seems to me to be a good place to start. I used to think that it was important to start conversation about peacemaking around the way we destroy each other, to talk about nuclear weapons, or to talk about is Star Wars the right approach, or can we afford to let down our defenses, or can you ever kill someone? Is it okay to sometime threaten someone? When is it necessary to harm someone? I thought those were the most important questions, and I still think they are important, but I don't think it's the first place to start. Because in the beginning, we create the enemy. In the beginning, we create the enemy. Before the weapons, before the arms race, before the violent words begin, comes the image of the enemy. We begin to hate, and we think others to death, and then we invent the means by which to do that. Then we invent the battle axe, or then we invent whatever the abusive tactics are to harm that person. So in the beginning, we create the enemy. And I think a lot of us have it backwards, that we assume the enemy might vanish if we only manage our weapons differently. And I think conservatives and liberals both believe this. Conservatives think that the enemy will be frightened into civility if we only have bigger and better weapons. Liberals think that the enemy will become our friend if we have smaller and fewer weapons. But both of them begin with the same assumption, that a rational assumption, that we are reasonable and pragmatic people, and therefore we can be peacemakers by rational negotiation. And it hasn't seemed to be working. It doesn't seem to lie, the problem doesn't seem to lie in our reason or our technology, but in the hardness of our hearts. And the way in which we build enemies and hate each other's enemies. And I think our best hope for survival today is to change the way we think about enemies, change the way they're perceived, and let's look at how enemies become enemies in the first place. Let's look at the eyes through which we see our enemies. Because I don't think we'll be very good peacemakers unless we come to understand how enemies are created and perpetuated. So that's part of what I want to do today, is to look at that. And I want to start by involving you a little bit. First, I want to involve you by yourself quietly. And I want to ask some questions. I want to have you close your eyes and imagine for a moment who have been your enemies in your lifetime. One of the advantages of doing an elder hostel is that you probably have had more enemies than I have, just for the sheer numbers that you've been living. So we're going to learn from your experience. But I'm serious about this. Even if you don't feel like you may have enemies, I think we all do. And I'm looking for both personal enemies and then corporate enemies. Who have been the enemies in your lifetime that our nation has had? And think about them. So if you could do that for a moment, shut your eyes and I'll just remind you what to be thinking about. But first begin, who have been your enemies in your lifetime? And think about that first personally. People you've come in contact with who have been enemies. Even if it seems trivial, let those feelings or those names come to mind. What happened to make those people enemies in your life? Was it their fault for becoming an enemy, or was it your fault for becoming an enemy? Who is most at fault for the enmity? Now I want you to change directions a little bit and think about yourself as an American citizen, and who have been our enemies? As people, who have been our enemies? Try to picture them in your mind. Try not only to picture them in your mind, but do you remember what we called them? Do you remember how we described them? Are there those who have been enemies before and are no longer enemies? And think about why that might be. And finally, think about to whom you might be an enemy. Think about people for whom you may be the enemy. Is that possible, and who might that be? Who might consider you to be the enemy? Okay, I want to take that. I realize I probably didn't give you enough time, but I want to take that and have you turn to at least one or two other people. Let's say a group of two, three, four, five is too many, but at least two or three or four, and turn and talk about who you thought about, and first take the personal and then take the corporate enemy. And let's just spend 5 minutes talking to a small group about who you envision, and try to be very honest with people, because I think we all, enemies are real, we all have them. So move your chairs if you have to. Hoping that we could do a little bit of sharing in a large group if it's not too intimidating. Let's start with the personal, and you don't have to name someone's name, but describe an enemy that you've had in your lifetime. Is anyone, for whom was it very, very easy?
The point they brought up a minute ago, what is the definition of enemy?
Okay.
We need to get to that first.
We'll get to that. I want to know what your definition is. Who have you considered enemies?
Yeah. Mine is immediately, my
fifth grade teacher.
I hate it and still hate.
Why was it? Describe.
She was terrible with children, and out of a class of 28, she plunked 13 of us. And I can remember standing at the board and being screamed at to find something on the map. I think she really was an enemy of all children.
Okay, that sounds legitimate. Good enemy. Good enemy. Just kidding. Somebody else. Yeah.
Declared, in this case it was a person accused me of doing something which I hadn't done, and I found out who did it, and who was also a peer of mine who never responded to what he had actually done, and this was never clear. And I felt like from that point, up to that point, I was his friend, and that point, I was his not apart from him, not necessarily an enemy, but apart from him.
Sort of a stake of a case of mistaken identity. Dyslexic. And because of that.
Because of that, I felt apart from him. In other words, I was no longer close. I felt I should be on my guard against him, where he was withholding evidence of which I was strongly accused, of which he had knowledge of, and I found out what the story really was.
Okay. Thank you.
In my case, it was when I was growing up, and my father had been the oldest child in the family and was classified as one of the breadwinners. And when he married my mother, it caused a lot of resentment in his family against my mother, and I had very poor relationship with my grandparents and with my other aunts and uncles on that side of the family. I don't know if you would classify them as enemies. It was just a complete closed relationship.
Okay. So because of something else that happened unrelated to you, you experienced the consequences of that.
Yes.
So, okay. Thank you. Anybody else? One or two more? Yeah.
And she was extremely jealous. I always got better grades than she did. So in order to get back at me, she would cook up these horrible stories about me and tell them to all the rest of the kids who didn't want to at me. She'd say I had done this or I had said that about them. And that went on all through grade school. And to this day, when I go back home, she won't speak to me. She still doesn't. So now I think that is really, because she did do a lot of harm to me, because she created bad situations.
Okay, so words can be quite violent. It doesn't have to be physical violence. Try to speak up so everyone can hear. Yep.
In World War I, our neighbor, Grandma Buck, who had been a very close friend, suddenly became the enemy because of Kaiser Bill and all the stories that we heard, and she was German ancestry, and so she became an enemy, especially to us children.
Because she was associated with a particular group that became a corporate enemy.
Yes, she was really, we wouldn't be surprised to find Kaiser Bill in her yard.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. Well, that's a helpful transition, thank you, because I want to talk about corporate enemies. And I'm going to put these on the board because we're going to concentrate more on those today, but we're going to make connections back to the personal enemies. But who have been our enemies? And let's just list them.
Who?
During your lifetime.
Japanese.
Japanese.
Germany.
Italians.
Russians.
Okay, wait a minute. Italians.
Italy.
Okay, I've got those Russians.
Koreans.
Vietnamese. Iranians.
Chinese.
Vietnamese. Libyans.
Iranians.
Nicaraguans.
Cuba.
Panamanians. Well, only Norway.
Okay, sometimes it's not the whole country, but it's the leader, all right?
Indians.
What? Indians, all right?
Blacks.
Iran.
Did I put down Iran? Got Iranian. Somebody else?
Catholics.
Catholics, okay.
No, when I was growing up, my mother was of the generation that she didn't care who we married, but never married a Catholic.
Okay. I grew up in the Lutheran Church. I was Missouri Synod, so if you married an ALC person, that was an LCA person. Are there those on here that used to be enemies and are no longer enemies?
Yeah.
Who would those be?
Japanese.
Germans. Part of the Germans. East Germans are still considered our enemy, so it's the West Germans are not considered our enemy. I think some people in this country at least would consider half of what once was Germany to still be enemies. Italians are not enemies.
The Mafia.
The Mafia is still enemies. What about words that were used to describe enemies? Do any of those come back to you?
Yeah, Nazi and communist.
Okay.
Japs.
Gooks.
Gooks.
Krauts.
Nips.
Heinies.
One thing we don't have on there is because of color of skin.
Okay. People of color.
Spicks.
Kikes.
Yeah. Wops. Okay.
Frogs.
For Japanese, the yellow horse.
Who are the frogs?
Frogs. French.
Oh, French. All right. I'm a little bit younger, as you can tell.
Chinks.
Okay.
Niggers,
right?
Spicks.
Anything common coming out about enemies? I mean, I don't have a particular answer here. I'm just wondering, are there any common themes? Are there common characteristics that enemies had?
They're different.
They're different from us, okay.
They're perceived as out to get us.
They're out to get us, okay.
Now we're afraid.
We put derogatory labels on them.
All right.
You know, like these names that have just been coming up.
We don't know very much about them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that always part of what being an enemy means, that you're sort of distant so that you...
Yeah.
Isn't there an old saying that you would never have an enemy if you really knew it?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, thanks. That's really helpful to get us start. One of my premises today, and some of you have already said this in one way or another, is that we do create enemies. And some of you may say, wait a minute, we don't create enemies, enemies happen to us. There are evil people in the world, there are aggressors, there are evil empires, there's bad men, there's wicked women, and they are out to destroy us if we don't destroy them first. There are real villains in the world. I mean, there's Hitler, there's Stalin, there's Pol Pot, the from Asia. There's those kinds of people, and I want to say up front, there is evil in the world. I don't want to deny that, and I do want to say that in part, enemies, and the accompanying hostility that we call enmity, can begin with simple brutality without provocation. There are people in the world who simply strike out for no reason. There are dangerous people in the world. So I want to affirm that, but I also want to say that That's only one way that enemies become enemies. And although brutality may play a role in enmity, it's not the single cause of enmity. Most enmity doesn't arise unilaterally, but many times enmity is simply created as part of a conflict where both sides want something and consider each other as obstacles to get what they want. And both sides want to win badly enough that they're willing to hurt the other side. The simplest example is two children who are reaching for the same piece of pie. They're in what, if you want a fancy name for that, sociologists would call that a conflict over resource scarcity. There's in which the supply of pie is limited, so both children can't have all they want. Other conflicts would involve position scarcity. Two people at the same going for the same job, or two teams going for the same championship. Now, when that kind of conflict happens within agreed limits, we call it competition, and it's okay, it's healthy. But when it gets outside of those boundaries, then it can escalate into a serious conflict in which enemies can be created. The two children reaching for the same piece of pie, they don't have to become enemies, but they can become enemies. So it's not always the conflict that is the problem, but it's the way in which the conflict is waged. It's the way in which enmity is created during the conflict. Now, regardless of the type of conflict there, when enemies are created, usually something happens in one's mind to build the conflict into enmity. And there's an escalation somehow. Enmity sometimes is in the eye of the beholder. Let me give you maybe a simplistic example, but let's say that I am walking down the street in Seattle, downtown Seattle at night, and I spot a scowling young man across the street, and I immediately think he might mug me. I mean, you never know, that kind of thing happens quite often. And I'm on my guard, I'm looking around for help, I'm thinking about how I might outmaneuver this guy, and he starts across the street towards me. Now, actually, he only wants to ask me directions. He's not really my enemy, but I believe him to be. So I take preventative measures, and I pull out my switchblade. Now, his real motivation or his real intentions may never be known at this point, because he says, hey, this guy's got a knife. I better go take it away from him before he hurts somebody. And he attacks me. Now, the hostility that I imagine has become real somehow. This is one example of how enemies can be created through what we call projection. Just write these on the board so you don't forget them. Projection, where one side, without sufficient evidence, imagines that the other side is hostile. Now, in this, the situation I just described, maybe I did have good reason for being suspicious because of my past experience. But there are all sorts of other ways in which, this is a very common way in which enemies are created. You project an unpleasant characteristic onto others, and then you dislike them because of that characteristic. A very simple, I do this all the time when I drive. Does anyone do this? If someone cuts me off, I think all sorts of horrible things about them. They are an irresponsible driver. They should go back to driving school. Especially if they have a big, nice car. They are simply rich people who have no concern for anyone else on the road. If they're a little bit young, I say they shouldn't be driving at that age. For a long time, women drivers was a big joke because women couldn't drive. I do that all the time.
What do you say if they're older?
If they're older, okay, well. It usually disarms me. I don't think anything. Sometimes we do this kind of projecting because of, it's hard to come to terms with some weakness in ourselves. I really believe that. If I'm greedy, I keep my eye out for hints of greediness in other people, and I despise them for it. If I tend to be aggressive, I can recognize right away aggressive signs in other people and denounce them for their cruelty that I can't face in myself. Or if I'm a workman and something goes wrong, I'm going to blame my tools. Or if this session doesn't go well, I'm going to blame Andra. Or I'm going to blame you people. It's not my fault. It's very common that when we're uncomfortable with something that's not going right, that instead of searching within ourselves, that we foist it off on somebody else. Now, it may not be one side's fault or the other, but it's a common reaction.
Aren't some of these things defense mechanisms too, that we're inbuilt?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. This is where scapegoats come from. I mean, you've all experienced this, whether it be at home or sometime at work, or when someone comes in angry from a previous argument and lashes out at you, well, they are shifting that anger from another earlier experience. This happens with nations too, and I think we ought to be aware of that. In the 1920s, for instance, many Germans who were upset over their deteriorating economy and the huge reparations they had to pay as a result of the First World War began to blame communists and then later Jews for many of their problems. This happens in our own nation. I'm reminded in 1983 of Ronald Reagan saying that communism was the source of all evil in the world. Even people who were extremely anti-communist said, now wait a minute, they can't be the cause of all evil in the world. But again, this is something that we commonly do. Now, when we move beyond what is completely accurate, sometimes we're moving toward what's called enemy thinking. Enemy thinking. When we're overly suspicious of people, when we doubt their integrity, when we, without a lot of evidence, are convinced that they're out to get us, then we're indulging in enemy thinking. On a personal level, this can happen if someone makes a remark to me and it becomes automatically a personal affront, I'm enemy thinking. Or if we say that someone's motives are disreputable because of some action that they've taken that we don't like, then I'm enemy thinking. For instance, if my neighbors put up a fence and I say, oh, well, they're just trying to keep me out, I'm enemy thinking if what they're really doing is trying to keep their dog in. That's what enemy thinking is. Another form of enemy thinking would be stereotyping. You're all familiar with stereotyping, where we attribute to all people in a particular category the unpleasant characteristics that may exist in a few of them. Poor people are lazy. Rich people are greedy. Old people make no contribution to society. There's obviously many others. One day at Holden, you can say all vegetarian food is boring. I mean, stereotypes are a very common way of just setting yourself up to be an enemy. It's easiest to do this kind of projecting onto unfamiliar people. Someone said that earlier. Enemies tend to be unfamiliar to us. That it's the stranger that receives most of the hostility. I'm going to put down here, suspicion of stranger. When someone speaks a foreign language or dresses differently or has a different culture, we begin to act in fear. This is like the man at night in downtown Seattle. I may have if he's strange looking, then I'm automatically fearful and suspicious. And my suspicion may turn out to be correct, but also I can, through my projecting my fear, I can create a situation that's hostile. European people coming to this country way back thought that they just assumed that those native people standing on the shores were hostile people and aggressive people, and they were projecting onto them the hostility that they themselves came with. And so any incident that happened, they immediately attacked them with muskets and with swords, and today we would call that a preventive strike. But in response to that, Indians in self-defense and in not wanting to be violently overcome, they responded sometimes by protecting themselves violently. And of course, they became an enemy. And in turn, the Europeans felt vindicated. These people are savages. We were right in the first place. They're just as bad as we thought they were. So you can see how all of this begins to escalate. And it escalates because it's socially reinforced, meaning that enemy thinking, scapegoating, projection, suspicion of strangers, stereotyping, all of that is socially reinforced. It goes unchallenged because the other people that we're around tend to be thinking the same way that we do. And we purposely don't spend a lot of time with people who are strangers or people who are perceived to be threatening to us or people who are opposed to our beliefs. So all of this escalates. Now, as this process escalates, what it eventually becomes, ultimately it becomes, is dehumanization. That's what all of these things lead to. Where the stranger or the enemy ceases to be fully human, but now just becomes an obstacle, becomes a barrier to be eliminated. And this, in my mind, is the only way that we can move to the stage of actual warfare. That it's only through dehumanizing the enemy that we can kill them, that we have to superimpose onto them a variety of dehumanizing faces to allow them to be killed without guilt. I think it's very, very difficult to kill a human being that has a family, that someone who is just like us. It's very, very difficult. It's murder. It seems like murder. So the task is to transform them into something less than human, and then it becomes something other than murder. Sometimes it becomes patriotism. Now, this is not something that just happens in the United States. It happens all over the place. It happens with every nation. What I want to do now is just to say that this is not new but very old, and I want to show ways in which, regardless of the historical circumstance, regardless of the war that people were in, there is an archetype of the enemy. There is a very common, standard repertoire of images that nations use against other nations to dehumanize the enemy. And so I want to expose you to some of those through not only verbally, but visually as well. And I'm going to pass these around. These have images on them. And as I'm talking, you can be looking at the images and maybe get a better sense of what I'm talking about. But the point is that we can find archetypes of enemies. And I think this is helpful for us to see how enemies become enemies and are perpetuated, so that when you go, I don't want to say out in the real world, I think up here we say when you go down lake, that you can be aware of how these are perpetuated, not only by your own country, but by other countries. And I think I have them listed on this. So that if you don't, that's not it. So that if you don't have the pictures in front of you, you can still know what I'm talking about. And I will pass these around various ways, and if I pass you two, keep the two together. But I'm going to be passing you around faces of the enemy, and just run through this list of 10 characteristics of enemies at various times. This is the prototype or the archetype of the enemy. First of all, the enemy is faceless, because we can perpetuate the horror of war and we can inflict suffering only when we blind ourselves to what we are doing. So even while we think very clearly and rationally about the weapons or the strategies or the tactics to kill them, we can't think about them too much. So in many various ways, we take away the enemy's individuality. You don't kill a person with an identity or with a family. You kill an idea or a force. Okay, that's the first one. The second one is that the enemy is not only against us, but the enemy is also the enemy of God. The enemy is in league with the devil. Can you think of instances in which this has been true? Whatever a society tends to consider as evil or immoral or inhumane or taboo, that usually becomes associated with the enemy. And of course, God is always on our side, even though in most wars, people of faith are fighting on both sides. The Civil War was a very painful example. Family members were fighting on both sides. World War I, someone mentioned the Kaiser. The Kaiser was painted as the embodiment of the devil. World War II, Christians fighting on both sides. The Germans were saying, Gott mit uns, and we were saying, in God we trust. Both sides claiming that the other side is evil. Most of our wars become holy wars, representing the forces of good against the forces of evil. Again, we're reminded of Ronald Reagan calling the Soviet Union the evil empire, where the U.S. represents total good and the Soviet Union represents total evil. One of the reasons I think we do this is to convert the guilt that we would naturally feel after killing someone into a source of pride. So we transform murder into devotion. So if you convince yourself that you're doing God's will, you don't really have to face the fact that you have killed someone. You're not responsible for that destruction because you're doing God's will.
Is that happening with the Ayatollah right now?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly.
Iraq war and
it's a holy war.
Really.
It's a holy war. Third, the enemy is a barbarian. Pass this one around. Make sure they get back into the back rows as well. The enemy will be portrayed as rude, as crude, as uncivilized. The enemy doesn't have a culture of his own. He only destroys culture. And this oftentimes is used by enemies, for instance, highly developed modernized cultures against cultures that aren't so technologically complex. I mean, the Greeks thought that any person that didn't have their language or their culture was simply uncivilized, and even you could kill their children because they were inferior. Again, the Japanese, this is how we treated the Japanese. Their culture was inferior. They were barbarians. Clearly, when we call someone a barbarian, we are dehumanizing them. We give them names like the ones that we said, WAP and nigger and gook. Even in the Revolutionary War, we called the British thirsty savages. That kind of dehumanization that portrays someone as a barbarian. If you look at those images that are being passed around, the images are usually ones that are larger than life or smaller than life. Either someone is a big monster, brute, a giant, or a little midget, but never human size. If you think of this dehumanization process on a scale of 1 to 100, calling someone a barbarian is about halfway. Calling someone a barbarian is making them subhuman, but they still belong to the human species, although they're an inferior member, and you can feel okay about killing them because you're advancing the cause of progress. Right? For the enemy is greedy. Let me start back here with this one. The two of them, if I hand out two, they should stay together. You know. The enemy is portrayed as insatiable, with an appetite that swallows up his neighbors and grabs everything in sight. You give him an inch and he'll take a mile. So we have to stand up to his aggression. And this is in direct contrast, of course, to ourselves, who are satisfied with what we have. We never meddle in the affairs of other countries. We're only defensive. Now, again, both the United States and the Soviet Union use this quite a bit. The Soviets think that private property is theft and that capitalists are the only ones that are greedy, and greed certainly has been abolished through communism. And on the other hand, according to the United States, communism is just another way to exploit the masses. So both sides use that sense of the enemy as being greedy. The enemy is also a criminal, a committer of crimes, a committer of atrocities. Now, usually by this, we don't always mean the people of a country, but sometimes we talk about the leader. Someone said that earlier, is that we like the people, we don't like the leader. And I think this is the case in Nicaragua right now. We care about the Nicaraguan people, but we see them as victims of a Sandinista government who our government says, the United States says, is sponsoring terrorism in Latin America. Now, never mind that those people have elected their own government, and never mind that there's very little concrete evidence about terrorist activity outside of the country. But on the other hand, we have the U.S.-sponsored Contras who have killed thousands of Nicaraguans. They are labeled as freedom fighters. So this image of the criminal and the opposite of criminal is used quite a bit. I just returned from the Mideast a couple of months ago, and it's just phenomenal. In the Mideast, I'm going to talk about this on Wednesday night in an optional session, but the Israelis and Palestinians both see each other as criminals. And particularly, Israel right now still says the PLO is a terrorist organization. At the same time, it legitimately accepts its bombing of civilians as legitimate retaliation. And you have both sides that have each other as criminal, and both involved in criminal type activities. One other example is, I was in the Soviet Union last year. The Soviet Union does this too. It represses some of its old people, but in its perception of the United States, it concentrates on the lawlessness and the criminality in our society. I was talking with a Soviet person, and I said, where are you from? And I said, well, I was born in Chicago. And they said, oh, Al Capone. That was the only thing that they knew about Chicago, was Al Capone. And I think if you look at some of our treatment of Soviets, you'll find the same thing, that we tend to emphasize what's worst. The enemy is also a torturer. In this way, we see the enemy as delighting in their killing of other people. That the enemy is just going around inflicting pain on others. And so what you do then is you emphasize the atrocities that have happened in that country. So for instance, when we invaded Grenada, there are all sorts of articles in the Soviet press about all the atrocities and the inflicting of pain. And similarly on our side, we have what we think of in the Soviet Union as primarily emphasizing Stalinism, and have this view of the Soviet Union as one big gulag concentration camp, and if everyone were given the chance, they would leave immediately. Well, that's the kind of enemy thinking that we do. It gives rise to this kind of litany, and I really think that this is a litany today in American culture, that we, whoever this is, it's not just in the United States, but we are law-abiding, they, whoever they are, criminals and outlaws. We respect our agreements and our treaties and abide by the rules. They are liars, cheaters, thieves who break treaties. We are peacekeepers. They are violent gangsters. They follow a policy of adventurism. We stand for justice and civil rights. They brutalize, repress, and tyrannize. Our leaders they govern with consent of the people. Their leaders are usurpers with no popular support. They'll eventually be overthrown. We give foreign aid. They support revolution. You can see how in various places, by various countries, those kinds of images are using. Finally, we go back to this. We're already on number 7. The enemy is also a rapist, a desecrator of women. The purpose of the good side, of course, is to protect women. The purpose of the bad side is to seduce and threaten women. And notice that women in this instance have no role in whatsoever except as victims or to be protected. So women are both the bait and the prize of warfare. Okay. The enemy also is a beast or an insect or a reptile. In the process of dehumanization, now we're finally making the enemy not only subhuman but completely animal. We say a running dog of capitalism, or a Nazi swine, or a Jap rat, or a commie bear. We obviously, they are dangerous animals who we are morally justified in killing without mercy. And the lower down they are in the animal scale, the more likely it is that we feel okay about killing them. We need to understand that in World War II, the anti-Semitic propaganda towards the Jews did this very, very effectively. It reduced the Jew to a rat, and that was integral in creating the extermination camps. This is what made the Holocaust possible. It's not by accident that Jews were taken to Auschwitz in cattle cars. That they were simply cargo on cattle cars going to an extermination camp by poison that was intended to be used as pesticides. So they were simply reduced to some sort of pest or insect that needed to be removed or exterminated. Finally, the enemy becomes death itself. That the enemy is death or either the agent of death. Let me pass this one out. We, of course, are the angels of light, but the enemy is often portrayed in these pictures as a skull. And in this way, when people die, the propaganda switches the blame for massive suffering and death from us to the enemy. Because we are not responsible, but we're only defending ourselves against the enemy, which really is the embodiment of death. The enemy represents death, not our weapons or their weapons, but the enemy is death itself. Then the last one, simply the enemy becomes an abstraction. That modern warfare is making this more and more possible, that the enemy simply becomes an abstraction. With new technology, with weapons that have long range, we don't need to think about the enemy anymore. That instead of having to be angry or passionate or fearful or brave, we simply need to be detached and cool and press our buttons. And it doesn't matter what's destroyed out there, we simply need to be on target, we need to be effective, we need to be and we need to distance ourselves from the enemy. And they're an obstacle to overcome. They're kind of like a robot or an automaton when you see those pictures. I want to conclude this part by simply showing you about an 8-minute clip from a videotape that says a little bit more about this, and then we're going to have some conversation. So these people are going to need to switch their chairs, and we can keep passing around those. Time, 20 minutes or so in conversation. I don't want to leave it there because it seems rather depressing, but it seems like the task of the peacemaker is to try to reverse this process of dehumanization, yet it seems so overwhelming, and it's sometimes when we have enemies it seems almost necessary. And I guess I want just some initial response about what people think of this process and how we might be about the task of reversing it. I have a couple ideas, but I'd like to hear from you first. Does anybody want to share?
Well, dehumanization, I think, wasn't just something that happened. That was something that was planned and pushed. It's propaganda. So what you have to do is be able to stand up immediately when propaganda starts out and diffuse it. And how are you going to do that? Because it'd be more propaganda.
Yeah. How do we do that? I mean, I think you're right that it's not, it's, they just don't happen. Mm-hmm. But it's a very elaborate system. And that propaganda is not something that just the Soviets had or just the Germans had. We have it in this country. And
we wouldn't be fighting them if you didn't.
Right. And it's very hard then as a peacemaker go up against the media. Unless some of us are part of the media, we have a role to play, certainly, but...
We tend to, I think for the most part, believe what we see in the media and news, but when you dig a little deeper, you find that they have very distorted, so many times they have a very distorted presentation of that news. You don't hear two sides to the story. And if someone has that power to go out over television, which most people watch their news from, I think we're getting a better distorted picture today of what's going on in the world.
Mm-hmm. Can everyone hear what's being said? I want to be sensitive to
that. I think that the more that we get to go to other countries or have them come over here and meet people from Russians or whatever, because we're here in the propaganda, and when you get so, you have some of them come over to your country and talk to you, you find out their peoples are more like hers.
That's really helpful. How many of you have traveled extensively? Do you have that sense that you have been able somehow to have another picture because of the traveling? Does anyone want to say another? I think that's a very important, and maybe it seems like a trivial thing, but I think people who have another perspective, not only of another country, but of that country's perspective of us, is very important in trying to break down some of these images. If you're able to see us from the outside.
Have everybody travel, that'll do any good. If you're having propaganda pushback.
They're traveling over here too, so we had a group of Russians that were in voicing, and they told their viewpoints, and it was, you don't really have to travel, you just need to go to
I think this is very important, but I also think that that's not going to solve the problem, because it's the leadership of these various countries that is different than our. We look at the world with a freedom outlook. We tend to think that the rest of the world has the same freedoms that we have. And from my understanding, it's not necessarily so.
Would that be as true for someone in another country that says, well, we look at the world with this mentality, it's not really true for the United States. They look with,
true.
I mean, that's sort of the problem, is that everyone's looking with their own viewpoint, with their own mindset, and not able to jump into the mind of someone else.
See how easy we have fallen into we and they, us and
yeah.
them. They have propaganda, we have intelligence.
Yeah.
We have to educate the younger, like they have in Ireland between the Protestants and the Catholics, to try to break that down through educating the children. You have to raise up a whole new generation sometime.
And that's difficult. I mean, I don't know if you know what kids see on TV today, but it's quite a bit different from that. Some of the video games were astonishing to me when I was in the airport flying out here. One of the video games was, you know, really the purpose of it was to destroy an enemy that was faceless. And it was obviously intended to be similar to a national enemy, and it was kind of a G.I. Joe hero. Now all of that becomes internalized very early on. So educating children. Yeah.
That organized group that I was really impressed with is Witness for Peace, who have taken, I think it's about 50,000 Americans to Nicaragua and had all kinds of experience of the people in different points of view in that country, and then expect them to come back to this country and spread what, tell what they have learned.
So you have sort of a multiplying effect, that you don't have to have everyone go down, but some people with a powerful experience come back and try to dispel some of those notions that we have.
We also have a team that stays there permanently that monitor human rights incidents and so on, so that they do have a source of information that is a little less propaganda than what.
It sometimes seems to me that we as a nation hold fast to the belief that everybody in the world wants just what we have, our way of government, all of the things that we have. I don't know that that's necessarily so. I think many nations look at us with some degree of envy, but they may not want our form of government. It seems to me like we make enemies sometimes by not accepting the fact that they don't always want what we have.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a double thing, in that it seems like we're threatened when people want what we want, but we also want other people to behave as we want them to behave. We want them to be like us in some ways, but when they want what we want, we're threatened by that.
But why is it more people want to come to this country, and I don't know of anyone who has wanted to immigrate to Russia?
Why is that?
They locked them out of their country, and we let them in here. I don't know why there is that difference.
We got automobiles, and they don't.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's it. But
what happens then when there are those gross differences between, standards in a country, and that perhaps, I mean, it has led to us creating enemies, but is there a way in which we can approach that disparity or that conflict in a different way, other than dehumanizing him? Tonight at Vespers, I'm going to be showing some slides of some experiences I have in the Soviet Union, where I certainly have experienced that, the tremendous, compared to our standard of living, the lack of material things. On the other hand, what's not emphasized at all is seems to be a much more relaxed feeling about one's basic needs being provided for one's entire life: education, housing, health care, and care for the elderly. All of that is a given. Now, the quality of it isn't what I am used to or what I would like, but it's as though there's something about that I like, and there's something about the quality of what we have that I like as well, but I don't like the fact in this country that it's not available to everybody. So there ought to be a way to somehow bring those two sides together and say, hey, we have something here that we believe in, and maybe you have something here that you believe in. Is there some way of bringing those two together? At least that was my experience in another country, of trying to discover what is the best of that we can learn from. Other comments here?
That particular point that you're making there of being somewhat open-minded about what they have as against what we have is one of the things about resolving conflict between us and them. And I thought maybe it'd be well to bring up the point that within this country now an institute has already been founded. You haven't brought that up yet.
No, go ahead.
With the National Institute for Peace, which has finally been approved by Congress and will be going into business for doing that very thing.
Yeah, the idea behind that is that we have how many war colleges in the country? 5 or 6? And we don't have a peace college. And it takes a lot of energy, time, and money to create those images that the media and creates. Wow. Perhaps we ought to have an institute or a college that tries to break those down. And so the idea here is to put some national resources into peacemaking and the breaking down and the resolving of conflict in peaceful means. Yeah.
They have put out a book about the National Peace Institute, which is titled The 100% Challenge. I have one of those.
Thank you, that's helpful. Yeah.
You might recall too, before World War II, we used to call our Army Department, we used to call it the War Department. Mm-hmm. I mean, it changes the Defense Department. Mm-hmm. Now, hopefully, it will be a Peace Department.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I knew that we've been working for years and years and years to get that National Peace Institute. I didn't know it had happened, which is in itself says something about what the media thinks.
Yeah. It did get less money than it thought it would. And it also was originally going to be called an academy, like the Naval Academy, but that language was changed so that it's now an institute. So it's a little bit less than the original vision, but it did happen, and I think it's a worthwhile thing.
Yeah. I think too in Idaho, where we have a group of people that are meeting, that's kind of trying to demoralize this concept, you know, their white supremacy against everything, except I'm sure that they aren't. We're mixed up too much to just plain white anymore, but then they think they are. And it's I think that's one of our enemies that we have today, is skinheads and as much as it is another country.
Mm-hmm. And the question is, for me anyway, how do you confront the evil that I think that they're about without in turn dehumanizing them as people? I mean, there has to be a way to confront the evil without, again, turning skinheads into something now that we reduce to less than humans. And maybe it's through, you know, somebody knows a parent of a skin, or someone actually meets, there has to be a way in which that's dealt with.
I know a man that lives at Coeur d'Alene, and he says, you know, Gilbert, is that the one that's head of it there in court? And he's like, he said he goes, has coffee with him, and he's a very nice person, really, you know, except that his viewpoint on the part of that thing, he's superior, I guess, to Jews or blacks or whatever, you know.
Well, if you look at those individuals, they're just like anybody else. They have parents. They were brought up in some families. What was some of the reasoning that was going on as they were developing as children, coming up through the school system? What was it that was leading them to that kind of conclusion that they had to feel superior? Mm-hmm. We need to look back into the roots of these families.
Okay. There are two over here.
Yeah. One thing that I was going to bring up in connection with this 100% challenge, in that book there's a chapter by Kenneth Boley. Some of you may be acquainted with him. He's a professor at the University of Colorado. And in that he said one of the things that would be helpful in changing our thinking about the enemy and so forth is that we should learn to love good and not hate evil. Because if we hate evil, then we justify evil things in order to fight them.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, that's helpful.
This is a digression a little bit, but for the lady in the blue shirt was talking about the organizations that they have in their part of the country. I've never been to an elder hostel before, but I look around me, and I wonder, those of you who have, is this the racial composition in most of them?
Mm-hmm.
No. Yeah.
We're that
lot
more Jewish.
Yeah.
Depends on the area.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This seems to me like sort of a specific group.
And that, and I think that's true about a lot of organizations, that they tend to be, that we tend to gather around people who are most like us and tend to not associate with people that we consider different or strange or people of another color.
This is true throughout the world.
It's true throughout the world. It's true in the church, which has a much different vision. I'm going to be talking about that tomorrow as part of the biblical basis for peacemaking.
We're the wasps, right?
That the church, 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning is probably the most segregated hour of the week. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's something in that in terms of trying to intentionally include people. I mean, does our experience become richer when we have people of different cultures in our midst, rather than talking about them?
We've tried to force this change, and it doesn't work that way, or we've tried it, at least. We tried to integrate with the black people in Milwaukee. We tried various different things, and they didn't want to be part of it any more than probably we did in this whole thing, which creates that segregation problem, which I'm afraid will always have.
Isn't it only natural in human that people tend to cluster in interest groups or with like, I mean, I think that's a natural thing, isn't it?
Not necessarily with the elder hostel. I don't want to badmouth elder hostel. We have been to elder hostels where there are many Jewish.
Oh yeah, we have
and black.
But when you look at the catalog and see what is happening at Holden, those people are going to look elsewhere.
This would probably discourage people of other faith communities more than, I mean, I think that we're very open to that, but again, because of the topic, it probably did discourage them.
Go with us to Dublin, to Ireland. There is a genuine mixture, whether it's religion or race or whatever it is. Not that they all agree on everything, and that's what makes it interesting.
Well, you wouldn't find this group agreed on everything either. I mean, I'm sure, you know.
I want to just spend 5 minutes at the end making some conclusions that I came up with in terms of... what we do with enemies. And the first one is simply that to be a peacemaker means to demythologize the enemy, and all of us need to do that individually, and we've already named some of the ways, and I think we're struggling with how to do that, but to demythologize the enemy, to refuse to project onto the enemy what we believe them to be without really studying them or knowing them. I think that's a tremendous problem, some of the misunderstandings between black and white, between Russian and American. It comes from a lack of knowledge. It comes from cultural differences. I think we really need to know more about our enemy in order to demythologize. The second one is stop playing the blame game. Stop blaming everyone but ourselves for the violence of war. I think we do that a lot. War is not often caused by villains or only evil people, but by reasonably good citizens. If you look at the wars throughout history, you come to the conclusion that it was the good Germans that created the environment for Nazism. And it was the good Americans that committed atrocities in Vietnam and who obeyed orders. And it was it's good people who go to war. So it's not enough simply to blame the other side or to even blame the war on the military or the media, but we have to take responsibility for the evil that's done in our name.
Don't you think, too, we have to be a little careful that we don't take all the blame ourselves?
Right. I mean, that can be the other side, and particularly there are people in our society for whom the blame has always been put there, and they need to... I mean, I think of this... women have often been treated as the blame in relationships. Sometimes women are perceived as being at fault more than men sometimes, and I think that men have to take the blame where it's due, and women don't need to take the blame that's always been put on them. But thirdly, don't be ruled by fear. I think fear is the biggest enemy that we have. If someone can get you to fear something, that person will have more power over you than anyone else, because you will do almost anything you can to get rid of that fear. You'll even kill someone to get rid of that fear. So I think to try to find some way to live without tremendous fear. If you think about peacemakers that you've known in your lives, it's usually people who live without a lot of fear, or maybe they have fear, but they're not controlled by it. Fourth is we will begin to be peacemakers not when we have better weapons, but we'll be peacemaker when we speak truer words to each other. I think we would be much better off if we name things for what they are, to call a thing what it is. So peace begins with fixing our language and calling things what they are. So when something when there is terrorism, call it terrorism, but be consistent about what terrorism is. Let's think about when we call people heroes, what does a hero mean? Let's define what heroism is and be consistent about that term. Or what does courage mean? What does duty mean? Let's redefine some words that have been defined for us by others. Fifth is a little more controversial. We talked about it a little bit, but listen to what the enemy has to say about you, because the enemy can be an important mirror. Sometimes you begin to learn what you have repressed, what we have repressed, and we develop a greater understanding of who we are and how we're seen from afar. I think that's extremely important. to look at the enemy, to listen to what the enemy is saying, that gives a clue as to what I'm, how I am, if my enemy sees me in that way. My rule of thumb is simply to look with suspicion on the rhetoric of my own nation and to look in compassion to the reasons of the enemy. And that doesn't mean I need to be duped, but it does mean that I need to be aware of my own propaganda, and I also need to be aware of how I am perceived and how we are perceived by others, even our enemies. And six, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because this is part of the subject matter for tomorrow, is that the most productive response to enemies may not be to try to dehumanize them, but to build up a rapport with them, to love your enemies, to bless them, to do good to them. Jesus' call to love enemies, which we'll look at tomorrow, is not a call necessarily to like them or to somehow develop good feelings about somebody who is bent on doing you harm, but to somehow be concerned for the good of that person or the good of that nation. And that means that you're concerned about them stopping the evil that they're doing, but you generally have concern for the good of that person. And we'll go into that more tomorrow. I think we're about out of time now. It's
one
about
more thing.
Sure.
I'm hitting the opposite side of what you're saying there, in a sense. What about the people who are trying to manipulate you, the people who are trying to push you into a war with somebody? What do you do about stopping that? Because it seemingly we always, no matter how true we elect, we seem to be getting people who want to manipulate us and use us for what they think is best. How do you get to that?
Well, again, that would be part of this one, is how do we take responsibility for the actions done in our name?
How do you do it?
Again, somehow, at least in this country, what we say, what we're fighting for, is our right to control our own government. And if we don't have control over it, then I don't know what we're fighting for.
Yeah.
It seems like, beyond voting, we need to all be active in making sure that that government represents what we stand for, and so that we all have an obligation.
That's where you feel like, here I am, an individual.
Right, you feel helpless.
How do you avoid or get around that?
Yeah, does somebody else want to respond to that?
Yeah. I think it's really important to have support groups. There are all kinds of support groups. If you're interested in peacemaking, there's Witness for Peace, and there's Fox Christi, and there's, you can name them. That if you don't feel as if you're just an individual, and you're getting support, and you're giving support.
I think it's very important because it's difficult to make a war by yourself. You need other people to do it. It's also very difficult to make peace by yourself. You need other people to do that. And again, I think if we see ourselves as isolated individuals, wars never happen that way. There's tremendous mobilization around a vision or around an idea or around a cause. I think we need to develop that same sort of mobilization around another cause or another dream.
Do you think the reason we didn't go to war with Nicaragua was because there were people who were able to get down there and see the situation, come back and state the public?
Well, I think the reason we're not in full-scale war with Nicaragua is partly because of that. I think we are at war with Nicaragua in many ways, and it has devastating results in that country, but I think the fact that some people have been able to have a presence down there has tried to limit as much as they can that violence. I think that's very important.
Do you think the average person in America thinks they're at war with Nicaragua?
I think we probably don't know what's going on.
That's the point.
Yeah.
I don't think people in America have a feeling against Nicaraguans, but it's just that they don't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, like all sessions at Holden, this one ends on a semicolon. And so hope that the conversation continues through coffee break, and I hope also that I know, at least in some of the other of my three sessions, there will be connections made to what Keith is going to say, and John and I haven't had too much chance to talk, but there will be connections between the various sessions, so don't be afraid to kind of interweave that as well. But thank you for the time, and have a good coffee break.